You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning to those of you in the Washington area, and good afternoon and good evening to those of you elsewhere in the world. I'm Suzanne Maloney, Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. On behalf of Brookings Foreign Policy, I'm really delighted to welcome you to this very special event, launching the book of our former colleague, Rush Doshi. Rush's new book, The Long Game, China's Strategy to Displace American Order, was released last month and offers deeply informed analysis on the evolution of China's grand strategy and outlines recommendations for how the U.S. should respond. In researching this book, Rush reviewed an impressive array of Chinese primary sources, party documents, speeches, memoirs from party leaders, to draw conclusions around Beijing's long game and focus. He charts China's strategy of hiding capabilities and biding time in the 1980s to a more aggressive shift in 2016 after a string of populist elections, highlighting the phrase, great changes unseen in a century. Examining China's true foreign policy objectives, Rush offers a valuable approach for how the U.S. should respond to China's rise. I am eagerly looking forward to hearing more from Rush and to what promises to be a rich and timely conversation. Today's event will begin in a moment with a moderated discussion with Rush and Michael O'Hanlon, our Director of Research, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Security Strategy and Technology in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. Their conversation will be followed by a panel discussion featuring Jackie Deal, who is a Senior Fellow in the Foreign Policy Research Institute and President and CEO of the Long-Term Strategy Group, Jude Blanchett, Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS, David Edelstein, Vice Dean and Professor at Georgetown University, moderated by our Brookings Senior Fellow and Director of our Center for the U.S. and Europe, Thomas Wright. In a moment, I'll hand off the program to Mike, but first let me provide a brief introduction of our featured author here today, Rush. Until earlier this year, Rush Doshi was Director of the Brookings China Strategy Initiative and a Fellow here in Brookings Foreign Policy. He was also a Fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, and part of the inaugural class of Wilson China Fellows. He's proficient in Mandarin and received his PhD from Harvard University. As many of you know, Rush is currently serving as director for China on the Biden administration's National Security Council. He completed the research and writing of his book before his government service began, and the book itself is drawn entirely from open source materials. I'd like to reiterate Brookings' commitment to independence, which is sacrosanct and foundational to everything that we do. And I'd underscore that the views expressed today are solely those of the speakers. Neither the book nor any of the remarks made at today's event necessarily reflect the views of the U.S. government or the National Security Council. Rush, congratulations on this very important new book. We are all looking forward to hearing your insights. I'll turn the mic over to Mike to moderate the conversation.
Thank you, Suzanne and Rush. Welcome back to Brookings. Thank you for rejoining us today. Thanks for your government service as well. And let me just start with a brief recognition of the book and maybe a round of applause that we can all give silently or virtually for your accomplishment. But thank you again for joining us today. I look forward to the conversation. So here's to you. By the way, let me say as I hold the book up, that before we get into the discussion, this is a very nicely written book, as well as a meticulously researched book. And it's about 300 pages of text, very readable, very digestible, and quite compelling. And I would just say by way of my introduction that Rush does offer policy recommendations, as you said, Suzanne, and they're very thoughtful and persuasive. But irrespective of where one comes down in the policy debate, I feel that Rush has done essential work that is just so empirically and analytically rigorous in understanding China, that wherever you are in that policy debate, you have to begin with an awareness of what he's accomplished and what he's presented. To me, this is one of the most important books on China I've ever read in my career. And so, Rush, congratulations and welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate all those kind words. Thanks to Suzanne for supporting the book when I was working on it at the Brookings Institution, as well as for supporting this event. I'm grateful to the panelists that you're going to have on shortly for taking part of their day to join this conversation. I think it'll be a very rich and interesting conversation, and I look forward to listening in as well. And Mike, thanks to you as well for just agreeing to kind of moderate this conversation. I've read so many of your works over the years. So it's pretty humbling that we'll not be discussing one of mine. And then I think I just want to thank also Andy Moffat and Emily Kimball and some of the others for helping organize this particular session, particularly on short notice. So with that, I just want to express my gratitude and look forward to the conversation.
Super. So as you and I have discussed previously, we would like to work a little bit through the three main grand strategies that you have identified that China, in your judgment, has essentially formed a consensus around during three different periods. And then, you know, you'll lay out those grand strategies and then say a bit more about each. And then, of course, wind up with not so much policy recommendations today as just what we need to grapple with and understand about China as it views the world of 2021 and beyond. So that's the logical sequence that I think we'll be following. But first, I wanted to offer you an opportunity just to say a bit more about methodology, about how you did this book, because again, I find the research so empirically and analytically compelling, so rock solid, that I think it's worth sharing with the audience a little bit about just how you developed your sources of information.
Well, thanks so much, Mike. And I'm particularly excited to talk about some of that. Let me just say at the outset, one other item I wanted to flag, which is, of course, I'm just here in a personal capacity as a former Brookings Fellow, just to talk about my book. And I want to make sure that that's clear to everyone who's in the audience today. But these are my own views from the book. And we'll talk a lot about history today in particular. And so the book itself, there's two methodological points. The one is the kind of how to think about grand strategy. And the second is how to think about how to do research on Chinese open sources. And I'll note that my colleague Jude Blanchett, who's going to be discussing some of this later, has also got an open source initiative at CSIS, which I think is very promising to kind of continue this work. So on grand strategy itself, it's a term we often use. It's a term that's pretty hard to define. And I tried to get at that question using some of the social science tools that folks at Brookings have used and folks in academia have used. And basically, the idea here was that if a grand strategy exists, how do we know it? How do we know if we see it? And there's a few things you look for. You look for concepts, grand strategic concepts in key texts, not like one master text, but the key ideas behind grand strategy in a corpus of texts. You look at grand strategic conduct. That is, are you seeing behavior that's largely consistent with what's outlined in those texts? And you look at grand strategic capability. That is, does a country have the institutions necessary to coordinate multiple instruments of statecraft in service of a grand strategy? As I try to argue in the book, and others have made this point too, what makes grand strategy grand isn't just the fact that, you know, you've got these ambitious end goals. It's also the challenge of coordinating multiple instruments to achieve those end goals. So with those three kind of broad conceptual categories for finding grand strategy in mind, that's how I kind of set about doing the research. And the research itself, you know, getting to that second point, was about, you know, doing two things, looking at party texts and looking at China's behavior and trying to understand that behavior as best we could. And on the textual side, Mike, and kind of as Suzanne mentioned earlier, one of the key things here was understanding that the party itself has a rich hierarchy in terms of how it guides, you know, policy. There's sort of the line, the Lucien, there's like the guideline, the Fangzhen, and then there's the policy, the Zhengzi. And there's sort of this hierarchy when things are said and sort of attached to each of those terms, you know where they fall in the system, and you can trace how those things change over time. The best way to trace how those things change over time is to have a pretty large database of these texts that you can kind of mine. And so what I tried to do is go get these texts. Many of them were open source. Some of them were accidentally posted online. Some of them were leaked inadvertently. Some were available in Taiwan and Hong Kong. Pull them together and study the evolution over time of some of these key concepts, and then match that up against behavior and ask ourselves, there's some really puzzling stuff that we see in the last 30 years. Why does China make this military decision or economic decision versus another one? And understanding that those puzzles are useful opportunities for us to make progress analytically in thinking about why and where Chinese grand strategy comes from, why it exists the way it does, where it comes from. That was the other part of the methodology. So with that very long and winding answer, that's basically how the book was written.
Thank you. I think it's a very useful answer. And just one further clarifying small technical question before we get into your three main periods and three main concepts. Different people use grand strategy in a slightly different way, I've noticed. For some, it's really fundamentally about security. It's about the power and safety of a state, its territory, and its people. Others use it much more comprehensively to essentially mean everything a country seeks to achieve in its foreign policy. Do you lean towards one of those or the other? Is this primarily about security, or is it about everything China wants to do in the world?
Yeah, it's a great question. And one of the ways to think about it, I think you nailed the two major approaches to the term, at least the ones that I'm tracking. One is it's about security and it's about how you use military instruments to achieve security. But we know that grand strategy is about more than military instruments. It's about economic instruments, technological ones, informational ones, political ones. So we have to widen the means that we consider. On the flip side, yeah, grand strategy could be the use of any means to accomplish any ends, but then it's no different as a term than the term strategy. So what we mean when we talk about grand strategy is how to use multiple instruments of statecraft to achieve strategic objectives often related to security. So that's how I'm thinking about it here. Granted, though, there's a challenge with that definition, which is what do you mean by security? And so I've defined security pretty broadly, and that's one area where people can disagree about the approach taken here. But that's basically how I've thought about it, the use of multiple instruments to achieve Chinese security and strategic interests, which in many ways are not purely defensive, as the book argues.
So before we get into each period separately, individually, and in a little bit more depth, could you just in a single paragraph lay out all three, roughly the duration of each and sort of the main concept undergirding China's grand strategy in each of these post-1949 periods that you look at?
Thanks, Mike. Yes, absolutely. So there's basically three broad grand strategies after the end of the Cold War that I perceive. And I don't make them up myself. I don't say, okay, I think this grand strategy exists from this period to this period because I see this pattern. I try to tie that definition of the existence of a strategy to a specific element of party thinking. And so in other words, in the Chinese Communist Party, there is the strategic guideline or the Zhanwei Fengzhen. And that particular phrase sits above other kinds of guidelines because it's the strategic one. So it sits above the political ones, the military ones, the economic ones. We don't really see economic guidelines as much. It's mostly political or diplomatic and military. But strategic presumably sits above all those. And that strategic guideline has only changed a handful of times. And so the first time, it was right after the end of the Cold War, we get hide capabilities and buy time or Taoguang Yanghui. And I kind of associate that with the strategy called blunting, which is about blunting non-assertively the foundations of American power to create some freedom of maneuver from China in a period right after the end of the Cold War of maximum danger, risk, peril, and uncertainty. And so that's the first strategy. And that goes on for about 20 years until 2008. And in 2008, you have a new strategy, which is more focused not on blunting American power, but building the foundations for Chinese order within Asia. And that strategy is accompanied by a change in those strategic guidelines as well, from hiding capabilities and biding time to actively accomplishing something or jiji yosuo zuowei. So the strategy, there's a shift in the guidelines, there's a big speech given in 2009 to mark that. And then there's kind of been now this third phase, and we don't have as clean a shift in the strategic guideline, but we have the dawn of a new phrase, which came about a few years ago, 2017. And that phrase, as Suzanne mentioned in her opening remarks, is great changes unseen in a century, bai nian wei you zhi da bian ju. And this phrase is debated. There's questions about what it means. I make arguments in the book about what I think it means, and I feel that those arguments are well supported. But the idea is that a combination of populist elections and other aspects that China associated with evidence of American decline have led it to be much more global in its approach. And it's taking blunting and building strategies and globalizing them, essentially, in a strategy that I call expansion. And again, it's accompanied by this phrase, which is not just appearing once or twice, but appears in all the major speeches by Xi, for the most part, as well as all the white papers. I mean, it's really just exploded onto the scene in a few years. And so I'm happy to go into greater detail on each of those, Mike, at your convenience.
And just to clarify the time horizon, yeah. And since most of the audience, of course, knows very well, but could you, because we'll come back at the end of our discussion to Xi Jinping specifically and personally, and how he relates to these. But the last phase that you talked about, the more ambitious global phase, that's several years into his leadership, right? It's not the immediate beginning of his leadership. It's several years in, right?
That's absolutely right. And I don't see this as much about his personality as much as a party consensus. And those key questions about when to adjust those guidelines and what that's based on, and that's based fundamentally on an assessment of American power, as I can explain in more detail shortly. That is a decision made by the party. In key text, it says it's the party central committee that makes that decision. So that's not to say that Xi Jinping doesn't have enormous influence over those questions and how they're implemented. But there is a strategic logic that sort of isn't just about his personality that pervades all of this, which I think is worth taking into account. Mike, to your point, that latter phase, at least according to my arguments in the book, probably begins around 2016 and 2017. So several years into his tenure. And conversely, the second phase of building Chinese order within Asia, it sort of begins with his predecessor, Hu Jintao, and continues into the first term of Xi Jinping. So there is some overlap across these leaders.
So thank you. Going back now to your first phase, first post-Cold War phase, the blunting. Let me ask you to just explain a bit more about what China was trying to achieve. But let me also put a little more of a point on my question, hearing you described the basic concept a minute ago. Why did China feel the need to blunt American power at a time when presumably things, apart now that admittedly Tiananmen Square soured our relationship in 1989, specifically at the human rights level. But overall, we think of this, if we look back to this period, maybe it's just the American bias, but a period, yes, of American unipolarity, but also a period of openness, friendliness between the United States and China. Apart from the human rights issue, there was not a lot of strategic concern yet in most camps. Why did China feel the need to blunt American influence in order to open up space for itself?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. This is one of the puzzles that I was grappling with when I started researching the book. I mean, it really, you could argue that that period of time, the 1990s, was an enormously benign period where the United States was welcoming China into key economic institutions, providing capital, technology, expertise, and its market to help China grow, wasn't particularly aggressive militarily within the region, and was sort of politically not particularly confrontational either with China. And yet that sense of anxiety still exists. And so I think if you think about this, so if you go back to the 1980s, we were quasi-allies. We actually worked together in many sensitive areas to counter the Soviet Union and really the cooperation truly was quite sensitive in some cases. We allowed, for example, the United States allowed the sale of an aircraft carrier, a hull, with certain key technology to China in that period so they could study it. And that would be unthinkable later on, but that was the nature of the 1980s. It was a kind of wilder and freewheeling period. But there was this change. And in the book, I mentioned this traumatic trifecta, three events. Tiananmen Square, as you noted, the Gulf War and the Soviet collapse. So Tiananmen Square reminded, I think, Chinese elites of the American ideological challenge and threat. The threat to a kind of Leninist party from sort of liberal values, which is an important point that we can explore further. And the second part was, the Gulf War, which reminded China of the American military threat. And a lot of observers back then, and I kind of quote some of them in the book, really thought that the Iraqi military would put up this kind of fierce resistance, that the United States would be bogged down in another Vietnam. And they knew that a lot of the weapons they had were very similar to the ones the Iraqis had. And yet the Iraqis didn't, they were completely defeated promptly, quickly, and in a way that was unnerving to China. So that was the American military threat. And then the collapse of the Soviet Union eliminated what was the shared binding between the United States and China strategically. That's not to say there wasn't still a case for alignment and coordination, if not cooperation on key issues, but the glue wasn't quite as strong after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that was very unsettling as well. And in the book, I try to show that top elites in China, including Deng Xiaoping himself, changed their thinking and talk the way they talk about the United States dramatically after this trifecta, but particularly after Tiananmen Square. And the other part of this that's worth keeping in mind is that the Chinese Communist Party is also a Leninist party. It believes, or the party itself has historically been modeled on Leninist precepts, Leninist architecture and hardware. And there's also a Leninist worldview that comes with that, that the party itself is key to accomplishing China's objectives of rejuvenation and national rejuvenation in particular, but also just revitalization, catching up with the West. And while in typical Marxist-Leninism, the party vanguard stewards a revolutionary cause, here the cause that the party vanguard is stewarding is fundamentally a rejuvenating cause. It's a nationalist cause. But if you believe in that mission and you believe in the party, then you also believe in a certain worldview, which is that there are threats to your ability to accomplish those objectives. And some of those threats are ideological. They come from the ways in which liberal values can undermine the centralization and the sort of elite ownership of a Leninist party state in ways that are really unsettling. So by virtue of who we are and what we believe, there was an element of threat. And then there was a strategic military element that was layered on top. And there was a pronounced sense that economically they were dependent to some degree on U.S. generosity. Since I can't pronounce the other word. And all of those things created great anxiety. And then, of course, Mike, I don't want to go too long, but if it's helpful, I could talk a little bit about what blunting looked like in practice.
Well, I would like to hear that, but I just want to also observe and ask you to comment that what you just said makes a lot of sense to me. When I think about some of the events that followed that you consider to be within this 20-year time period of relative continuity in Chinese thinking after the trifecta that began the period, there are a lot of events, right? There are the Taiwan Strait crises of 1995-96, there's the Kosovo War, including the accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy, which very few Chinese think could have been accidental. There is 9/11, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, the bogging down in Iraq with that conflict. So all of those events transpired in this 20-year period that you're identifying. And I guess you're suggesting, by the way, also NATO expansion and the Clinton administration's national security strategy of promoting enlargement and expansion of NATO and also democratic nations. So I guess that all fits, or most of that fits with your argument that these sorts of you know, somewhat confrontational exchanges between the United States and China, or demonstrations of American willingness to use its power, they all sort of fit with the Chinese theme of blunting, right? Or how much did any of those events really shape or reinforce the Chinese worldview in that period of time? Or were they relatively inconsequential compared to the trifecta at the beginning?
Yeah, so one of the key arguments of the book is that grand strategies change very slowly. That grand strategy is kind of like a aircraft carrier or a large cargo vessel. Like, it's really hard to turn it. It takes a lot of time. And so what does change a grand strategy is sharp discontinuities in the ways you look at the world, and sharp discontinuities in your perceptions, particularly your perceptions of the key variables that you think matter most. For China, the key variable that mattered most was its perception of American power and its perception of American threat. And that variable changed fundamentally in the late 1980s, when China went from a quasi-ally of the United States to what it called the United States after, as the U.S. was sort of its principal adversary, or zhuyao duishou. So the idea was that the United States now looked different to China. It was more powerful, it was more threatening, but that change didn't occur with Kosovo. It didn't occur with the Taiwan Strait crisis. It fundamentally, that discontinuity, that sharp departure, fundamentally occurred between the years of 1989 and 1991. And that's why I think they're so salient. Once that change has occurred, and that new strategy is launched, these other events, they're extremely important. They result in tactical adjustment, but they fundamentally are part of the same path. They continue to sustain the same strategic logic that was developed earlier. And so the Taiwan Strait crisis, people will often argue that was the period where China decided to launch a truly asymmetric force structure. But as I argue in the book, that's not really true. A lot of the key decisions, investments, and discourse around this began as early as the Gulf War, and really right after the collapse of the Soviet Union in particular. And the kind of institutionalization of that into military guidelines occurs well before the Taiwan Strait crisis, the third one. And so you see a number of elements that China then takes on, right? On the military side, they're trying to blunt American power asymmetrically. So using mines and missiles and submarines to undermine American power projection in a way that's cheaper, asymmetric, and not that flashy, not as flashy as building an aircraft carrier would be later. Now, the economic side, it's about joining these international economic agreements because they're good for China economically, although there was some doubt about their political implications, that they might overthrow the Chinese Communist Party. So they took on a real cost. And one reason they were willing to do that is there was a belief that joining these economic arrangements would also tie the hands of the United States, which they saw for Tiananmen Square, was willing to deploy coercive economic leverage against China. And then at the political level, there was a real concern about U.S. institution building. And your point about NATO expansion is an excellent point, because there was a view that the United States might try something like that, as implausible as that may seem to all of us Americans, in the Asia Pacific. And there was concern about APEC or the ASEAN Regional Forum as being vehicles for that. So China on the political level would join these institutions and try to undermine them from the inside. That's all a long way of saying the key change in the way they looked at the world, and therefore the key change in their strategy, was in the late 80s and early 90s. And that led to a very enduring approach, which is non-confrontational, but nonetheless quite directed at blunting American power.
So now to get to the second period, if the Taiwan Strait crisis of 95-96, the Kosovo War and the accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, 9/11 and its aftermath, the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, if none of these were big enough deals to change Chinese grand strategy, what was in 2008? Why did things change so abruptly at that point? Obviously, I know some of the answers, but it's still, I'm still intrigued as to just how you'll prioritize, you know, having read your book, I know some of what you think, but I'm still struck in this conversation that a lot of things did not change Chinese grand strategy for 20 years. But then finally, around the time when Barack Obama was elected president, you argue that things did change fundamentally. So what was it?
Yeah, so all those other events are in the direction of bias, right? So they, Taiwan Strait crisis, Kosovo, the Iraq war, and our reaction after 9/11, which was, of course, a demonstration of military power and our ability to organize coalitions, which was, you know, quite impressive. All of that is biased in the direction of thinking America is very powerful. So it sustains that belief. But what makes 2008 different is you now have a precipitous event, a discontinuous event, a sharp, shocking event, which is in the other direction, which is the idea that the United States is not as powerful, that maybe the U.S. model isn't quite as effective, that the United States, which China thought to that point, had this incredible capability of reinventing itself, boosting productivity, being an economic dynamo. Maybe its model is wrong economically and then politically. And so 08 begins this reckoning with the idea that maybe the United States is actually weakening. And so the financial crisis precipitates it. Ahead of that, there's, of course, a few others. You know, there's getting bogged down in Iraq. There's our response to Russian assertiveness before and after. And all that kind of combines, but with the 08 crisis being the major event to give China the confidence to move from blunting American power to building the foundations of regional order. And really, because that event is so running, it runs so contrary to their prior beliefs, that's why you see a change in strategy. And really, that change is marked. On the military side, it's a movement away from the mines and missiles and the submarines. And when they were doing the mines and the missiles and submarines, they were self-consciously avoiding aircraft carriers or very expensive surface vessels going into serial production. A lot of other capabilities that they thought would be vulnerable and that they thought would be threatening. Well, after 08, they thought, well, we need these things because we can't just deny the U.S. the ability to access the region. We got to project our own power. So we see far greater investment in carriers and in surface vessels, et cetera, than we saw earlier. In power projection, essentially. On the economic side, we see not a desire just to join U.S. economic institutions or U.S.-led economic institutions, but now a desire to kind of create China's own and to wield economic tools, both on the inducement side, in part with Belt and Road, but also on the cost side, in economic sanctions, sometimes declared, sometimes undeclared, against other countries. So Belt and Road, a real opportunity to reshape the region. And you see at the political level a desire to join regional organizations and reshape them or to create China's own. And particularly to create its own, that's the major change. And all of this happens actually under the Hu Jintao administration, right? This is all 2008, 2009. And Hu Jintao gives a speech, as I alluded to earlier, in 2009. It's an ambassadorial conference address. And at that time, the ambassadorial conference addresses, which were basically the entire foreign policy establishment, and just about every ambassador, were only delivered once every 6 or 7 years. And so this was a big deal that he was giving the speech. And at that speech, he takes high capabilities and buy time, that previous guideline that guided the period of blunting, and he puts it in what he calls a dialectical relationship with actively accomplishing something, or and he says we got to stress that latter half of the dialectic. And that's pretty arcane and obscure when you read it in the text, but it's actually a pretty momentous decision, because he's taking the guy who sort of ran Chinese grand strategy for a while and domestic policy, Deng Xiaoping's fundamental point of view, his fundamental guidance, and adjusting it, which is not a trivial thing. And that adjustment is, in that same speech, he lays out many of the military, political, and economic steps that I just talked about in less detail. We don't have the full speech. We have the excerpt that the party published, but there's plenty of detail in it. And so that's where we get to this next second phase fundamentally.
So in this phase, we begin with a relatively calm China-Taiwan relationship, right? Because President Tsai is in power in Taipei and is not really interested in roiling the waters. So we don't see too much turbulence initially on that front, but we do see a lot of Chinese assertiveness vis-a-vis the Senkaku Islands disputed with Japan and, of course, called the Diaoyu Islands by China. We start to see, if I'm remembering correctly, the Nine Dash Line being discussed much more, and China essentially claiming something close to sovereignty in the South China Sea. And then we see the Chinese militarization of a number of islands and reclaiming land features. Is that all consistent? Does that all follow from this grand strategy?
I think it does. I mean, there's an important differentiation between the strategic behavior and sort of the tactical behavior. There's different levels of granularity, and no grand strategy can account for every single action that the Chinese state takes. But many of these actions, particularly in the territorial realm, are associated, in my view, with the fact that Hu Jintao tells at that ambassadorial conference, he tells the leadership that's assembled that China needs to make more offensive moves in territorial disputes. And that's his phrase. And that actually is quite different from what he says just 2 or 3 years earlier at a Central Foreign Affairs Work Conference speech. Now, those are also given infrequently, so they're also very important. But at that speech, he uses language that's much more about shelving disputes and jointly developing. It's much more benign language. And so there's a change in the language. And that change is reflected in the thinking. I mean, putting aside the party texts, which we have to parse, there's a line in the book about from a famous sinologist talking about parsing those texts as like drinking buckets of sawdust or something and munching rhinoceros sausage. And that's kind of true. And sometimes you go from that to the think tank discourse, and it's not quite as, maybe it's a little livelier than some of our think tank discourse, Mike, but it's, or maybe a bit more, it's certainly more politically associated with the leadership, because they've got to make sure they're towing the line. So it's useful, but it's also more candid. And there you have a lot more focus on these exact questions. And there are some indications that in the system right then and there, beginning in 08 and 09, that funding was dramatically increased for territorial dispute kind of studies, for studies of maritime rights and sovereignty questions, because they wanted to really make progress on these questions. That changes, by the way, 10 years later. So that's kind of how I see it. I see a lot of this is wrapped up in a fundamental shift in brand strategy, but I fully acknowledge with a degree of modesty and humility that no grand strategic explanation accounts for every aspect of behavior, but it does account for the major muscle movements. What weapon systems do you buy? What economic initiatives do you launch? What political organizations do you create? That question is very much dictated by their brand strategy.
Now, I want to thank the audience for sending in questions, and in a minute, I'm going to wrap a few of them into one final question to you, although I want to talk about the third period and Xi Jinping a little bit more first. But I have a question that follows on about the second period first, and that's going to be, this is a little bit of an interpretive question, but you know, you present your three grand strategies in a very empirical way without a lot of, you know, value judgment per se. But I'm wondering, as a student of international relations and as a student of China, do you see the second period as one where China should be a little more sharply criticized by the outside world? Or do you feel that, do you not really think in these sorts of terms? I mean, there are realists who just say, as China becomes more powerful, it's going to become more of a problem. And we might as well not associate or attribute normative terminology or judgments to that. It's just sort of the law of physics of how states behave. You know, this is sort of the John Mearsheimer way of looking. There are others who would say, no, China had an opportunity for a long time to work with us, and at some point sort of chose more to work against us. And maybe we made mistakes too, but do you identify any part of this progression so far, either the 1989 to 2008 or the 2008 to 2016? Is there a period where you say to yourself, come on, China, come on, Beijing, you really didn't need to do this. You really should have known better, and you chose a confrontational path. Has that happened yet in the time period we've been talking about, or does my question not really even make sense to you?
It's a great question. I don't have a great answer on the normative question. I haven't sort of evaluated the strategies entirely in terms of their efficacy or in terms of like whether or not they are correct or incorrect and some other with respect to some other, you know, standard. But I do think that your question gets at a very important point, which is, can we reassure? You know, we talk, there's a lot of discussion about deterrence, but is there also the possibility of reassurance here? And I think that's one that I try to explore a bit in the book historically, because as we were discussing earlier, the 1990s should have been a period, if you ask me when was the period of maximum U.S. reassurance, that should have been a period where China could have felt reassured, because there was so much the United States was doing to incorporate China into the international system. And there wasn't as much, there wasn't as much great political tension, with the exception of a few events, between the two countries. Particularly after 1993, when you know, the relationship sort of reset after Tiananmen Square more fundamentally. But we don't get reassurance. We don't succeed in reassurance, and maybe we never could have. And so during that period, even now, you have very senior Chinese officials whose job it is to kind of interact with the United States. These are retired officials. Say, you know, throughout that period, the United States wanted to overthrow the China system of government. That they continue to say that, even though their job is to not say stuff like that, because they believe it, I guess, so strongly. And at the same time, you take the WTO discourse. I mean, Jiang Zemin convenes when he's leader right after, right in the run up to and then after the WTO session, there are a series of high level meetings convened. One particularly high level meeting, it's like every minister, every single provincial head, everybody all in one place to hear a speech about WTO accession. It's a big deal. It's like getting every single governor and senator in one room and minister and, you know, cabinet official in one room to hear our discussion of some U.S. economic initiative. Like, and what does he say in that address? And I think this really gets at the reassurance question. What he says is that the WTO accession is an opportunity for China economically, but it's also an incredible risk, because the forces in the West want to use WTO accession to overthrow our system of government. And so even this major event, which was controversial in the United States, which was incredibly important for China's economic ascent, was seen as part of an effort to maybe keep the party down a bit. And I think that really is one of many anecdotes I could give you that shows the challenge of reassurance, even in the most benign period. And that has implications, obviously, for the future.
That was around the year 2000, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. 1999 to 01 is when that debate is really intense in their system.
So could you please say a brief word about the final strategy, and again, Xi Jinping's role in it, and to what extent it transcends or goes beyond him and reflects a deeper consensus in Chinese thinking? Also, just how dangerous is it for the United States? We know now that China wants a lot, right? But the other question, of course, is what will China do? What risks will it run? What costs will it pay to achieve its maximalist ambitions? It's one thing to want a certain kind of world. It's something else to be willing to risk war in order to achieve it. And so that's the other side of my question about this third period, if I could ask you to elucidate a bit more.
Absolutely. I think the third period begins, you know, after the global financial crisis, there is this surge of populism, not only in the United States, but across the West. And if you look at China's scholarly discourse, the references to populism skyrocket. There's just so much attention and study on Western populism in that period because they see it as something fundamentally compromising the ability of government to work. They may be wrong about that assessment, but that's their assessment. And so they think that the West is kind of trending towards decline in that period. But then with the major populist elections of 2016, Brexit, and the election of President Trump, their systems begins to really conclude that the United States is in some kind of a political decline. And so previously there was a belief that, you know, whenever the U.S. declined, there was an effort to reinvent itself. And that was a key element of American power. It's the resilience. But they thought, okay, well, if the political engine is broken, then that resilience is much less, it's less detectable. Maybe it doesn't exist. And again, I'm not suggesting that they're right. I'm just simply saying that that was their assessment. And so with that assessment came this phrase we mentioned earlier of great changes unseen in a century. And that phrase has a pretty interesting historical context, right? Because if you go back, the Chinese Communist Party kind of emerged from the nationalist ferment of the Qing Dynasty's decline. So a lot of elites watched over 60, 70 years the Qing Dynasty decline, and they were pretty upset about what that meant. And they wanted to fix it. And there was a lot of nationalist thinking. And in that soil, one of the kind of plants that emerged was the Chinese Communist Party. And a lot of people were drawn to it because they saw it as a vehicle for achieving nationalist aims. And in that rough period, 1870s, well before the party, there was this statesman, Li Hongzhang, who was a major Qing Dynasty self-strengthener trying to protect the dynasty against foreign depredation and make China basically great again. And he had a phrase, which was that China was experiencing great changes unseen in 3,000 years. And that phrase has a bit of cachet because it's seen as a marker of the beginning of China's, you know, humiliation. It actually began a little bit sooner, but that phrase is a symbolic ingredient in that. And the current phrase, great changes unseen in a century, rhymes with that past phrase. But the difference is that this time, instead of it being about weakness and humiliation, it's much more about strength and opportunity. That's not to say that China doesn't perceive significant risks, and this gets to your point. They are likely to perceive risks, and the literature on great changes unseen in a century suggests that they're aware that risks are very high right now. But the opportunities are in many ways still greater. And that is, I think, what drives what I call this third phase of Chinese strategy of expansion, which takes the blunting and building strategies from the earlier period and applies them on a global stage. And so when you kind of look at it from the perspective of the phrase's provenance, which is this kind of nationalist phrase, it gives a different texture to the nature of this particular moment of strategy. And a lot of the secondary sources, a lot of the think tank material, et cetera, suggest that the goal is to kind of displace the United States, the order the United States has created, maybe surpass the US in key fields like economics and technology by 2049, which will be the centennial of the founding of the People's Republic of China. So that's a sense of the time horizon. But in many ways, the competition will be acute even well before that particular date. That's also acknowledged. And so great changes unseen in a century captures the risks. It captures the opportunity. It believes that the opportunities exceed the risks. And it is now a motivating phrase in just about every major speech and white paper.
So that leads to my final question, which is my effort to take some of the excellent audience questions and bring them into a single thematic sort of package, which flows from your point about China's global ambitions. And there were a number of questions about specific countries, key countries in this broader calculus. So to what extent are you worried? You don't have to answer all these, but there were questions. To what extent are you worried about China-Russia cooperation? To what extent do you expect China and India to get along or not? To what extent do you think the United States and Europe can work together in trying to channel China's rise in a more productive and less threatening way? And then there were also questions about Japan and Africa, but maybe I shouldn't throw the kitchen sink at you. So, no. But anything you want to speak to on that list, please do, again, with appreciation to those who sent in the questions.
Well, and thanks to the audience members for sending them in. And I think I can address almost all of it in one sense, which is that if you look at the Chinese discourse on what they see as the future of competition, they perceive, they believe that the West and the United States and others will sort of increasingly work together in key areas, maybe in an ad hoc fashion. And they think they have to do the same thing with other states. That's a little harder in their own estimation because they don't have the same network of alliances and historical partnerships. But they do have this close relationship with Russia, which they see as a foundational ingredient in this approach. And they also believe, as key scholars have indicated, like Yuan Peng, who is affiliated with a ministry, he's the head of a Ministry of State Security think tank. Ministry of State Security is the leading intelligence service in China. And he is one of the key thinkers. He's a very inventive and original thinker. And he talks a lot about how he sees the future of competition being, you know, assembling ad hoc coalitions on key issues. And I've given you a sense of where he thinks the U.S. coalition will drive its strength. And for him, you know, not only is there the Russia point, but there's also what he calls the Belt and Road countries or the Community of Common Destiny countries, countries that are bound by China to affinity, by economic ties to China rather than pure affinity, and also bound by sometimes shared views on governance, including questions about liberal values and democracy, or sometimes countries that have elite connections to China that are enduring and deep, and others that are sort of benefiting enormously from Chinese security implicit partnership or from economic benefit. And so that is true in Africa and Central Asia and parts of South Asia. It's true all over the world. That's a global question. So all the countries you just mentioned from the perspective of this Chinese academic and many others within the system there, those countries are going to sort of increasingly, you know, move in different directions on different issues, but they're going to be sort of ad hoc camps. And it's not exactly the block thinking approach of yore, but it might be more fluid. But nonetheless, the challenge, the game, as it were, is to kind of bind different countries together on key issues. And so that's true, globally. And that, I think, leads to a final point, which is in the Chinese estimation, this competition is now increasingly global, whereas blunting and building had very strong regional dimensions. This third phase, if it can be said to exist in the wake of this great changes unseen in a century concept, has a much more global feel to it. And that's not just regional, but it's also functional. It's in key domains like economics, technology, finance, emerging technologies, and obviously in security and political institutions. And so the nature of the competition is much, the aperture is much wider, and that requires pulling in more countries. And again, that's exactly how the Chinese are writing about it.
Rush, thank you. Very invigorating and insightful conversation. Fantastic book. I'm going to hold it up one more time and encourage everyone to peruse and learn from this outstanding piece of work. Want to congratulate you again. And as I hand off to Tom Wright for the panel discussion and wish everybody the best. Again, Rush, thank you and kudos. Job well done.
Thanks so much, Mike. I appreciate the chance to be in a conversation with you today. And I appreciate the kind words about the book. And to the audience, thank you for joining. Again, everything is personal capacity, but hopefully it's interesting. And if you do pick up the book, some of the chapters can be useful FDA-approved sleep aids. Thanks.
Thank you kindly. And Tom, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Rush. That was a terrific conversation. And I think sets the stage perfectly for our panel to discuss the themes of Rush's book. While I'm waiting for the panelists to join, I'll just sort of start off and say I thought this was an extraordinary book, an incredibly important contribution as a non sort of China expert, but a student of grand strategy and US foreign policy. I just learned a tremendous, you know, amount from it. And I think its implications for what we do is pretty profound. I particularly liked, of course, the very sort of empirical primary source and rigorous methodology that I think really just added a lot to our understanding of that perennial and incredibly important question of what China wants from its foreign policy. So we are joined by a really great panel to discuss Rush's book, and it's a follow-on from the conversation with Mike. David Edelstein is the Vice Dean at Georgetown and a Professor of International Relations there. Jackie Deal is a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and president and CEO of the Long-Term Strategy Group. And Ju Blanchette is the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS. And you have all written extensively or worked extensively on these questions. So I think we'll get into that. And we'll also try to go to the audience questions. I will say I've never seen in my sort of 10 years at Brookings, I've never seen so many audience questions that came in advance. I think we're at over 100. So if we started, it would literally be a 100-year march to get through all of the questions, but I will try to integrate them into the conversation as we go. And there's some very important points that are raised in them. So thank you for submitting those. But Jackie, if we might sort of start with you, I'm going to ask you all sort of a version of the same question to start off with. But I'd love your sort of reaction to Rush's thesis and just what your initial reaction is and what you particularly liked about the book. And also if there were, points of departure where you had sort of a different view with some of his analysis. We'll come on to the implications for US foreign policy and other aspects in a little bit. But why don't you kick us off, please?
Thanks, Tom, for the question and for hosting this panel. Huge fan of Rush's book. It's really excellent. I guess I'm a little bit biased because we used to work together to benefit from his research earlier in his career. It's a seminal contribution, the way he painstakingly reviews primary sources and the record of behavior over time, documents trends, looks at discontinuities, and establishes that China has been following and executing a grand strategy. The strategy shifted at key points when Chinese thinkers and planners, the architects of the strategy, have detected shifts in the environment and shifts in China's relative power and the threat from the United States in particular. There has been evolution, but there is a plan and an effort to execute a grand strategy. And I think it's particularly important for in the United States and in the U.S. government to take that on board, because I think we've gotten out of the habit of believing in grand strategy, believing in its viability, in its importance to try to understand trends over time.
Jackie, I think we're getting some interference on your line there. So we might try to fix that and come back to you if that's okay. So there's a little bit of choppiness there, but we'll come back to you in a moment. David, if I could turn to you and just pose the same, question, and you've written a very sort of important book. I'd like to ask you about that on the next question in terms of its relation to Rush's argument, but just, taking the book on its own terms, what was your reaction?
Yeah, thanks, Tom, and thanks for the invitation to be here. And I'll start by reiterating what others have said. It's a terrific book, and I really do think it's perhaps the best, and maybe not even perhaps, simply the best kind of study of Chinese grand strategy over the last 30 years or so that we have. And the empirical research is truly impressive. I think what I would focus on is just as kind of a question and kind of a provocation that I think Mike got at it, some of his questions to Rush is what exactly are the kind of underlying drivers here of Chinese grand strategy, right? And I thought the kind of the back and forth between Mike and Rush over, why did it take to the 2008 financial crisis, right, for there to be this change in Chinese grand strategy? Why does it not happen as a result of, say, the developing U.S. struggles in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? Why is that not seen in China as a moment that is kind of propitious for a shift in Chinese grand strategy? So there's kind of these dogs that don't bark, in a sense, right, of kind of non-changes in Chinese grand strategy that I think sort of need to be explained. I would also say that there are kind of more general questions about what's driving Chinese grand strategy here. And I'll just, let me just highlight a few, right? One is the book conveys an almost kind of Chinese obsession with the United States, right? That everything is responsive to the US. I have a question about whether that's an accurate kind of portrayal of the way that the Chinese thinking about their grand strategy, right? Is everything necessarily in response to kind of, shifts in U.S. power and perceptions of U.S. power, or other things that are underlying these shifts, namely shifts in Chinese power, right? So the kind of causal story that Rush tells is one of shifts in U.S. capabilities, power lead to shifts in Chinese grand strategy. Well, over this entire same period of time, China is getting wealthier and transforming that economic wealth into military might. Why isn't that driving Chinese grand strategy independent of anything that's going on in the US. Along kind of similar lines, right? I think we have lots of other work here. I think particularly sort of the fantastic work that Taylor Fravel has done on kind of Chinese military doctrine about the ways in which kind of Chinese domestic politics, right, and kind of concerns within the party really drive, say, military doctrine. It was interesting to me just how kind of absent those considerations are from Russia's book, right? Again, it's all about kind of reactions to what the U.S. is doing or the U.S. perceptions of U.S. capabilities. And I'll kind of leave this point by just saying and kind of throwing out there, right, that the reason why I think this is an important conversation, right, and to identify what these causal drivers are, is because I think there's a question about what could be the driver of the next transformation in Chinese grand strategy, right? Based on Russia's book, I don't think we should have any confidence that what is Chinese grand strategy now is just going to continue even as far as 2049, right? That seems optimistic, right? Or a kind of a perhaps misguided assumption to think that it's going to continue that long. So what would it be that would drive China either to adopt an even more aggressive grand strategy, right? In all the conversations recently about Taiwan, for example, or on the other hand, what could it be that would drive China to maybe pull back, right? And pursue a more modest grand strategy? Would it necessarily be driven by what's going on in the United States, or are there other dynamics within China or within kind of thinking about Chinese capabilities that could drive those transformations?
Thank you, David. And I think that sets the stage nicely for some of the conversation later on. But Jude, if I could come to you now and just get your sort of general reaction. And obviously, you've done a lot of work on this topic, too. But what do you see the main contribution of Russia's book being, and what was your overall reaction to it?
Yeah, well, thank you. And actually, David just made more eloquently a few of the comments that I was going to make on just observations that I think are necessary components to have a real robust picture. And again, as David said, not only to a complete understanding of what Chinese grand strategy is now, but I think critically what's going to drive it and shape it moving forward. Just a positive comment, not a criticism per se, but maybe just flagging something that I think is worth mentioning. Russia has definitely now set the standard, I think, for how primary source documentation has to be included and utilized when we're making pronouncements about what China wants or doesn't want, or more specifically, what the senior leadership of the party wants. And again, I think this has been highlighted as one of the great strengths of the book, and rightfully so. Let me mention, though, briefly about where I found that this strength of the book was also one of the areas I had the most question marks in my margin notes. And I appreciate Rush flagging that we're doing an open source project at CSAS, which is why I've got the juices flowing on this issue. What I've realized is, and this may be obvious to many, but primary source research is really bedeviled by a number of methodological challenges, with selection and interpretation being critical. Selection, because you have especially when you're talking about primary source document in the internet age, you know, on my screen over here, I almost always have about 50 tabs open from various Communist Party websites, publications, government policies. There's almost an infinite mass of material. And deciding which document you're going to focus on or not requires a good deal of subjective judgment, but also a framework so that you're articulating why this document and not another document. And so there were often times where I was wondering why Rush had chosen, for example, to highlight one versus another. Some of these are no-brainers. A speech by Xi Jinping is always important, a plenary communique, the work report from the 19th Party Congress. But once you get under that, I think a clear articulation of why some statements or others is critical. And I raise that for one important reason. Xi Jinping in 2017, for example, made a statement to a group of foreign visitors where he said, look, we're not trying to export China model. What we do here is just for us. It's not for anybody else. Now, I think I and Rush would both read that statement and go, nah, I don't know if I buy that. But why we don't buy that is really critical. Why we decide that statement isn't necessarily have full fidelity to China's intentions or capabilities is a really critical piece of this framework. And I because the primary source documentation is one of the great strengths of this book and selling points, it also to me is an area where I think we should continue to tread lightly, because oftentimes these are subjective choices by an author. I do this myself, where you really need to understand their underlying framework for why they selected and put weight on one statement versus another, because we could have two parallel debates right now. Someone could be excavating all the comments by the senior leadership of the party where they talk about a warm and fuzzy vision of global cooperation, win-win, opening up the market for foreign companies, and another could be pulling statements that paint a much darker picture. And without understanding really the context, the domestic politics, the audience, then it's really hard to parse these statements. So there's a lot to praise about this book, and I think the praise has been noted here, but I would just say as a methodological point of view, I found this a great strength, but also I think there are some areas where as an analyst, I come to differing conclusions based on some of these subjective judgments about which documents you pick and which you put weight on.
Jude, can I ask you a quick follow-up just before we go back to Jackie, just on that point? I guess one thing I'm sort of wondering is, we've had a big debate, you know, amongst China scholars and more broadly on what it is that China wants. To what extent is that debate, if not over, I mean, debates are never over, to what degree is it sort of settled? Or are those who sort of say, you know, this is a lot more ambiguous, China doesn't actually seek to displace the U.S., you know, are they likely to have sort of a substantive critique of this book? And is that going to be an ongoing, you know, question and debate in the field?
This is a hard question. I think especially now that the political system is centralizing and the arena of debate and discussion is necessarily restricting as Xi tightens control. So the robust debates and discussions you would see in Chinese IR journals or in-person meetings or on track 1.5s and 2s 10 or 15 years ago are absent now. But that leads you to an analysis that only the remaining voices are precisely where the debate is, or that much of the dissenting voices just aren't out there in the debate and discussion because Xi has grabbed control. I think clearly this general view of China as seeking to become a global power, maybe even one of the dominant powers, is uncontroversial, and I think probably should be uncontroversial. But what does it want to be the sole power, that is to fundamentally displace the United States and see the United States fail, I think is an open discussion and debate. And that's one where maybe in a friendly way, I have my spin on the ball is slightly separate from Russia's, because I don't have the degree of certainty he does in precisely what China's grand strategy is. A word like rejuvenation is like saying China's foreign policy is based on rejuvenation is like saying American foreign policy is based on liberty. It is maybe an orienting position, but it doesn't really tell you much about the granularity, especially when we're looking out on China's ability or not, in my case, to think that China can plan out 10, 20, 30 years. I don't think it can. So I think rejuvenation is the top of a mountain to which China is going to be constantly orienting and reorienting itself towards.
Thank you. Thank you, Jude. Jackie, to come back to you, I'd love you to finish your thoughts from earlier when we had some of the technical sort of audio interference, but also, you know, to react to what Jude and David said. But you've also written extensively on and worked on, you know, the concept of strategic surprise and how countries can be surprised by other countries and by geopolitical developments. David sort of finished his answer by talking about what that next phase of Chinese strategy is going to be. I mean, how do you sort of think about that future evolution? And obviously the definition of surprise is we can't really predict it, but can you give us sort of any guidance on what you're sort of looking for there?
Sure. I mean, I'd go back to just on this question of what China wants. I think a term that Rush used in the book that's persuasive is partial hegemony. And the United States obviously doesn't want any country to exert partial or full hegemony over the world. We prefer a world where states are free to engage with each other, respect each other's status under international law, and benefit from peaceful exchange. But I think Rush establishes that part of the CCP's conception, the Chinese Communist Party's conception of what it requires going forward, is the ability to some extent to dictate terms in the region and beyond that. And in terms of surprise, I guess what I was saying earlier was just that we may have, the United States may not have, may have stopped believing so much in the possibility of grand strategy or the pursuit and execution of a strategy over time. And certainly we've long been skeptical of the ability to achieve geopolitical ends through surprise, because we're a democracy and we expect that things will leak and it's hard to kind of conspire or plan in secret, whereas China's record of conflict initiation in the time of the PRC since 1949 has been one of extensive use of surprise. And going back to some of the previous panelists' comments on the internal or domestic drivers of China's perceptions of the environment and changes in its strategy, and building on Rush's work in the book, he talks about at the end the Chinese faith in, and this is something that Jude Blanchett has written a lot about too, the fourth industrial revolution and its possibilities, and the kind of, in a sense, great wager that the Xi Jinping administration is placing on the possibilities of the fourth industrial revolution and China's seizing the commanding heights of the information technology, big data, artificial intelligence possibilities to continue its growth, makes for a situation where, together with the kind of limits on China's old model of growth that is now bumping up against or confronting, because of demographics and because of the inability of the rest of the world to continue to consume 8 to 12% more China's goods every year, China is bumping up against the limits of what has been a very benign, favorable environment for its economic rise to date. And it has great hopes in its ability to use technology to continue to grow and build wealth and then exert control over its own population and populations abroad. But it seems to be in a rush. And so I worry that we could be surprised by a potential calculation from Beijing that a window is closing and that action needs to be taken to lock in its gain or lock in its partial hegemony, its ability to dictate terms sooner rather than later. And this is something that you see on the military side, in addition to the economic side, because only 100,000 evacuees from Kabul ago, a week ago, before we started evacuating Kabul, the China Aerospace Studies Institute of the U.S. Air Force released reports saying it had just discovered a third huge field or big field of Chinese intercontinental ballistic missile silos. And this is the third field that has been revealed or reported on this summer. There are others reported in June and July. So now China is, in the U.S. Air Force Institute's words, on track to approaching parity with the United States in long-range delivery systems for nuclear weapons. And this follows a period which Rush documents of going much more sort of explicitly full bore on the PLA's conventional buildup in terms of power projection capabilities, conventional like aircraft carriers, amphibious warfare capabilities. So on the conventional and on the nuclear side, we're seeing almost a rush. Xi Jinping keeps talking about 2027 as it's the centennial of the PLA. That's a 100-year anniversary of the Chinese military as part of an interim stage towards 2049, the rejuvenation goal. And in 2017, he had already said China's military needs to be fully modernized by 2035. So we may be in this period where Xi Jinping, for a variety of reasons, demographic, economic, perceives that China's window, the CCP's window of opportunity to really advance its status, lock in its partial hegemony, is narrowing, and he needs to act decisively to take advantage of the trends and the opportunities, and also to ward off or forestall some of the downside scenarios that he could foresee if China doesn't seize this opportunity, given, again, the kind of headwinds from its demographic problems, environmental problems. He may think this is not just a time when we have opportunities, but it could also be a time when we need to act sooner rather than later. And so I worry that the United States could be surprised by that within the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years.
Thank you, Jackie. And Jude, I want to come back to you on that because I know you had a great article in Foreign Affairs on a similar argument recently. But David, if I can turn to you next, I mean, you wrote a book several years ago, Over the Horizon, on sort of the way in which declining powers sort of calculate their policy toward rising powers. And I guess what I'm, and I think what your argument was that, you know, the uncertainty over what the rising powers' behavior is going to be can sort of impair a balancing response by the pre-existing hegemon. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, are we at sort of a critical moment now in US-China relations that if sort of views of policymakers and others is crystallizing around, you know, an argument that we now know what China's intentions are, how does that change America's sort of geopolitical calculations? And I guess I would also invite you to comment on what Jackie and Jude have said as well, but to what extent is this debate in academia on China's intentions in international relations, to what extent is that more settled now maybe than it was a few years ago?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And I will say kind of self-indulgently, right? One of the reasons why I like this book so much is it fits well, I think, with the argument that I make in Over the Horizon. And you got the argument right. But one part of it, right? One part of it is that the kind of declining great power in this context, the United States, relatively declining great power in the United States, because of that uncertainty, refrains from balancing, and also refrains because it may have kind of short-term threats that it's more worried about than a potential long-term threat from a country like China. And then simultaneously, the rising power has incentives to refrain from provocative acts that might get the attention of that declining power, right? And so I think that period kind of before 2008, right, that period when we think about, and many people have now sort of expressed regret over, of kind of cooperation between the United States and China. And the logic of my argument is explained by this combination of a China looking over the long time horizon and thinking, let's not provoke right now, and a United States that is more focused at that moment on Iraq and Afghanistan than it is on countering the potential long-term threat from China. I think that's all changed now, right? I think China has kind of the Chinese time horizon is shrinking. I think the US time horizon has kind of expanded somewhat, right? As it's moved, as we all know, to move out of Iraq and very recently Afghanistan. And so I think that combination kind of foretells this more competitive relationship that we've seen between the United States and China. So I would just say that it's consistent with my argument, and I would just say it's consistent with what we've seen in past dynamics between rising powers and declining powers, right? I don't consider myself a China expert per se, as much as a kind of great power politics expert, right? And this is a dynamic that we've, a movie that we've seen before. On your question, I actually think within academia, at least, there's still a pretty robust debate over Chinese intentions. And I would kind of characterize it this way, right? I think there are those who think that China has aggressive intentions, it has global ambitions, and is acting on those global ambitions because that's what great powers do, right? And as they get more powerful, they get more ambitious. I think there is another school of thought that sees this as, in the kind of international relations literature, what we would describe as sort of a classic security dilemma, right? That both the United States and China are doing things to secure their interests, but in kind of taking steps to secure their interests, they simultaneously threaten others, even if they don't mean to threaten others. And that's a way of interpreting this dynamic. And then I think there's a third argument out there that has said that, you know, what China is really after is kind of domestic security, right? And that what matters most to the Chinese leadership is a world that is safe for Chinese authoritarianism. And as long as it's safe for Chinese authoritarianism, then they don't have much kind of ambition beyond that, right? And my sense is that within academia, at least, there's still a pretty robust debate over which of those kind of angles, and you could imagine combining them, right? But which of those angles is the correct take on where Chinese intentions are at the moment?
Thank you, David. I mentioned earlier just your article, but you had an article, Xi's Gamble in Foreign Affairs, in which you said that Xi Jinping is a man on a mission and that he basically sees this time horizon issue of his, he has a time horizon issue of his own, which is he has a limited window of opportunity now in the next sort of decade to accomplish what he seeks to accomplish. I have to say that makes me very concerned because it's a, you know, Jackie was talking about that too. But if we take Russia's book as sort of a baseline for what China's intentions are and you add on to it a leader who, you know, adheres to all of that and then some because of his own sort of personal ambition, it would seem that we're in a rocky road. Could you comment on that, but also, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, the importance of the individual in this case and to what extent do you, you know, you look at the primary source documents and long-term strategy, but we also have a particular leader of China who has centralized control.
Yeah, thanks. Great question. And it's really interesting hearing, I think a lot of folks, you know, obviously David's great book with Jackie's comments, everyone is now really, I think, coming to see this element of time as being a real critical component and, or maybe a correction from what may have existed a few years ago where the view was long-term competition, China on a 100-year, you know, marathon. And that was always a thesis devoid of any real, I think, granular look at what policy documents are saying. How, you know, Russia has some great quotes in the book from Xi where he explicitly says the next decade is critical. And, you know, when you look at the problems that China faces, if it's going to position itself to become a global power, the bills for these all come due one way or the other in the next 10 to 15 years. And again, most of Chinese policy documents now are targeting the year 2035, not 2049. It's this kind of 15-year window. I think to your question, Tom, I think it's a really interesting argument of this kind of agency versus kind of structure in Chinese politics and strategy. And I don't have a good answer to this, but I try to answer it by counterfactuals. There's a contingent element to who gets to become the top leader of the Communist Party. You know, it's the result of some backdoor, you know, interfactional bargaining, you know, elite interest bargaining. And there was a period in 2006, 2007, where we weren't sure if Xi Jinping or Li Keqiang was going to be the, you know, get the top vote. And I try to think, what would be different if Li Keqiang had become general secretary? Was it ineluctable that we were going to get to this point in 2021 with this sets of ambitions from China on this timeline? Or does contingency matter? And there's a whole lot when I look back at the past 10 years at a granular level of where Xi Jinping's personality and his own particular set of interests and ambitions really seems to be a shaper of what China has done. And so you can imagine, you know, for Spinal Tap fans, the volume now is at 11. I think the volume would have been 5, but that sort of 6 volume point difference is pretty critical here. You can imagine a Li Keqiang being a little bit more patient as we're seeing the end of the Obama administration and the entrance of the Trump administration. I certainly don't think you would have seen many of the antagonisms or irritants in the bilateral relationship surrounding the role of the Communist Party and the role of ideology. So I think that's going to be a really interesting element of this debate as we think about the critical question, which is what lies ahead. Does a post-Xi Jinping China, whenever that will be in 2080 or in 2 years, I don't know, are we now in this sort of structural path? Or is there the ability for China to course correct in the same way that, you know, with the death of Mao in 1976, I think few were expecting that by, you know, 79 or 80, that China was going to be in this pretty significantly different trajectory, one that was more befitting U.S. interests and indeed the interests of the Chinese people. I think that's a really critical question. I end on a note of pessimism, though, which is Xi Jinping is young for a dictator. These guys seem to live to be 138. He won't be in his 80s until the mid 2030s. He has no significant power base that's going to challenge his rule. And I think if we look at you know, comparative examples, these guys don't change their mentality or worldview as their power increases and as they get older. So I think the realistic assessment is this is going to be a one-way ratchet of repression and global ambition that the United States and its allies and partners are going to have to find a way to, if I can borrow from Rush, to blunt.
Thank you. Yeah, he's only 68, as you point out, so there's potentially quite a lot of time ahead. I think we should turn to policy questions. And obviously, Rush was speaking in his personal capacity. We are not bound by that here because none of us are serving in the U.S. government. So I think it would be interesting to look at, you know, the Biden administration's policy toward China. And I guess, Jackie, if I could start with you. I mean, my question is, you know, if we take this sort of analysis as the baseline that this is what China wants and we're facing in with what you said and Jude said about Xi Jinping's personal timeline on this, you know, how does the policy response sort of measure up to the diagnosis? Is the administration doing enough? And what are some of your concerns maybe about where there might be a gap?
Sure. Well, thank you for the question. I mean, in a way, certainly Rush in the final or the penultimate chapter of the book lays out a kind of framework for an asymmetric response or set of policy responses, a strategic response to the challenge we now face from China. And just to justify starting there, I wanted to mention in response to some of the previous comments that in each chapter of the book, one of the things that makes Rush's argument so powerful is he explicitly deals with alternative theories of the case that have been advanced by other China scholars about what's driving China's behavior or how it's not the product of a strategy. And he empirically, rigorously deals with those alternative explanations and then refutes them or rebuts them. So I find it very powerful because he doesn't deny that there are alternative theories or that there's a theory out there that China is not strategic or that interest groups, lobbying groups are driving China's behavior, not any kind of grand strategy agenda. And then he shows how the observable empirical behavior we see is more likely to be a product of the grand strategy he identifies and traces in these authoritative texts than anything else. And he also has this useful appendix where he talks about how he selected the texts that he draws on. And there's a kind of hierarchy of authoritativeness, which I think echoes some of the work by Peter Mattis and other people who've been writing about how to use Chinese texts, open source material. And for instance, you should take a speech that was meant for an internal audience and rate that more highly, or it's more valuable perhaps than a speech that was intended for external audiences or translated into English or delivered in English before it was not necessarily for internal use. So I think Rush is trying to be very selective and thoughtful about which sources he draws on. And then that brings us to what do we do now based on the case, I think, that he persuasively builds. And he says we need a kind of asymmetric approach. We are probably not going to be in a position to be able to meet China ship for ship or aircraft for aircraft, he says. I think we have some room on the defense side to grow, though, substantially relative to our history. You know, our percentage of GDP that we're spending on defense is roughly 3-4%. And as I had a chance to write about recently in Politico, most of that spending has gone to operations and maintenance or activities, investments associated with wars we've been waging in the Middle East and Central Asia, which is very reasonable. We were in wars, we wanted to win them, we were spending to win them. We weren't necessarily spending on the kinds of capabilities that would be best suited to blunt or meet China's nascent power projection. So in keeping with Russia's prescription, we could asymmetrically on the military side invest more in the kinds of our own American anti-access area denial missile systems, or they're transferring them to regional countries around China or encouraging those countries to acquire them from each other. So we have room to grow on the kind of defense investment side. As I mentioned in my last response, I'm worried that we're setting ourselves up to be surprised, even though we shouldn't necessarily be, by China's very rapid conventional and nuclear buildup. And again, we have room to grow. We seem to be spending, you know, $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there on various other important causes. So we might want to think about ways that we could spend more on defense to shore up our position vis-a-vis China and the Chinese threat. And also, as Matt Pottinger has written in a new foreign affairs piece that cites Russia's book, we need to think very hard about the degree to which we are engaged in providing the capital and the technology to the Chinese companies and the military civil fusion establishment that we may be forced to take on sooner rather than later. So the SEC chair, Gary Gensler, earlier this week said that he is actually going to enforce a law that was passed in 2020 that says that Chinese firms that are listing in the U.S. have to follow our accounting transparency requirements. And if not, they can be delisted as soon as 2024. So that's good news. I mean, basically, we should be thinking much more carefully and selectively or rigorously about which Chinese state entities or entities connected with this military industrial establishment of China we are providing know-how to or capital to. And so we have to be thinking about which countries or which companies can list on our markets, which companies can get smart capital, venture funding, private equity funding from the U.S. We should be working with our allies so that they are coordinating with us, so that we're all thinking much more systematically or rigorously and selectively about where we do business, where we provide know-how and funding to the system that may be about to kind of frontally take us on. Tom, you're muted.
Sorry, you would think I would have that down now, but thank you, Jackie. We have a lot of questions, as I mentioned earlier. I've integrated some of them in already. David, if I could turn to you next. I mean, several of the questions are basically about the role of ideology in U.S. policy toward China. If President Biden's sort of framing of this as a competition of different systems is an appropriate approach. A number of people have asked about the security dilemma that you mentioned. Feel free to comment on any aspect of the policy, but I think if you're so inclined, it'd be interesting to get your sort of thoughts on any sort of risks that maybe the administration should be thinking about as well.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And I think that goes, you know, this question about ideology goes to my initial comments about kind of what are the fundamental drivers here, right? And I think there is, and to this question about, you know, where are there still debates on this? I think one of the places where there is still very much a debate is over how much of this is China as an ideologically driven actor or the United States as an ideologically driven actor, right, who are in a clash over kind of ideologies and political systems and what's going to be the kind of predominant system globally, or at least where there's going to be space for different systems globally, versus this is a story of great powers being great powers, right? And that when great powers get more powerful, they threaten each other regardless of ideology, right? And that ideology is kind of it's a side story here. It's a distraction from what are underlying kind of power dynamics. And, you know, I think this goes in a way to some of the discussions that have been had over, you know, calling this Cold War 2.0 or thinking of this as a Cold War and drawing analogies between the U.S. and the Soviet Union relationship during the Cold War and the U.S. and China now. And I think that turns in part on kind of some of these questions of how important you think ideology was then and is now. I think it also turns, and I'll just say this, we haven't really talked about this very much. I think it also turns on some of the kind of economic issues that I think are really vital to this relationship that are fundamentally different than what the U.S. and the Soviet Union, where the Soviet Union was basically aiming to be autarkic and wanted nothing to do with the global economy. China very much wants to be a part of the global economy. There was something in one of the Politico emails I got this morning about the kind of the next space for competition being over cloud computing, right? And that, you know, we think of, you know, Amazon Web Services or Google or Microsoft controlling cloud computing. Well, what if China significantly moves into that space, right? And think about all the data that's stored there and what that means and the economic, potential economic implications of this. And, you know, I'll put a plug in here for work that I know Brookings has been engaged in, but also my colleague at Georgetown, Abe Newman and Henry Farrell, their work on weaponized interdependence. And I think thinking about we've been very much focused on the military diplomatic components of this. But as Rush said at the outset, another key dimension of grand strategy is our economic instruments of grand strategy. And that's a complicated story that I think is going to kind of continue to play out. And that I think the Biden administration is going to have to figure out kind of where is the level of engagement between sort of decoupling, right, and kind of a heavy level of interdependence that the United States is comfortable with going forward, and how to manage that.
Thank you, David. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because there are a number of questions on that. And that was actually my slight spin variant on the question for Jude, was just on this interdependence question. But Jude, if we could come to you, I mean, also feel free to comment on any aspect. But I guess, as David mentioned, one that we haven't really sort of discussed is that it is a different type of competition. And, you know, that has evolved over time as well. So I'm just curious what do you think the U.S. response should be, but how does this play into Xi Jinping's sort of strategy? I mean, he seems to have been unilaterally decoupling in a strategic way. But if we project out over this next sort of period of time that you have written about, how does that all play out, and how should policymakers here think about that?
Yeah, thanks. It's I was recently reading some work by Barry Naughton, who has a really good short book on Chinese industrial policy, you know, and he traces this really beginning back in the 2006-2007 period, where China begins to really make this push towards indigenous innovation and start to ramp up its industrial policy. And I mention that only to say, I think oftentimes we are positioning China's economic policy, you know, in this new kind of autarky, as a result of U.S. actions since 2016. But of course, this logic runs deep in China. And I think as they've understood the strategic benefits of integration, they've also seen the national security risks for the Communist Party and its hold on its grip on power. And so there's always been this tension or balance. But recently, this is obviously ramped up with policy frameworks like dual circulation, which are pushing for a recalibration of just how open and exposed China's market is. And indeed, looking at some of the regulatory actions coming out of Beijing over the past six or so months, Xi is yet again trying to navigate this tension between control and innovation and openness. But I think what we're seeing with the Xi administration is, whereas Deng and Jiang Zemin and even maybe Hu Jintao had more confidence that the political system could weather more robust global integration, I think the Xi administration is tipped heavily, heavily towards this ideology of national security, which is infusing almost all of their policy decisions and how they're looking at the world. And so this, from our perspective in the United States, you know, thinking about the next 10 or 15 years, I see no off-ramp for the Xi administration of continuing to push down this road of tightening, of closing, of seeing national security risks everywhere. And I think that's going to work to China's detriment, even as they're pouring gobs of money into industrial policy, which has important strategic implications for the United States. Regardless, even if these quote unquote fail, the knock-on effects are going to be significant and potentially deleterious to U.S. companies and markets. But from the broader strategic perspective, I think there is this question mark of, is Xi pushing the country in a direction where he is fundamentally undermining some of the tenets of national power, which his predecessors had imperfectly built up over three decades of reform and opening? And I, unfortunately for us, we're probably not going to know the answer to that for another 10 or so years, which means the United States won't do well to sit on the sideline and wait it out. But nonetheless, I think we do want to assess with a more granularity where are areas of Chinese power that we see the Xi Jinping pushing it into a cul-de-sac, and maybe the United States can sort of deprioritize and focus instead on the areas where we see Xi Jinping is be able to break through. And just a final comment, it strikes me right now we're in a worried about China everywhere all the time posture, which has the functional effect of meaning we're not prioritizing scarce resource and bandwidth. And so that will mean we need to move into a position where we see behavior or activities from China in a certain geographic location that may bother us, but we have to have the strategic maturity to say, we can't focus on that because it comes at the exclusion of focusing here. And that ability to allocate scarce resources with attention, it, to me, seems to be a lacking component just of the US in general, and even our own sort of tribe in the think tank world. It's just we're worried about everything all the time.
It's interesting, Drew, just on one sort of final comment on that point, which I think is a fascinating one. Is there some sign, I think, from the administration that that has affected their policy toward Afghanistan? You know, so obviously President Biden has had a view for a long time about withdrawing, but my sense of it is that you have additional support for that initial decision within the administration precisely because they wanted to refocus on the Indo-Pacific. And a number of scholars sort of wrote that the US should remain in Afghanistan because of China, and they rejected that view, and they rejected it for the reasons sort of that you said. And the president in one of his speeches talked about threats of today and tomorrow rather than of the past. So it will be interesting to see if that continues to be a factor. But we are actually out of time. This is an extraordinarily rich conversation. Thank you so much to the three of you for joining. And thank you also to Mike and, of course, to Rush earlier for the keynote conversation. Rush's book is The Long Game, China's Grand Strategy to Displace American Order, and it's available now in all bookshops and online. So I strongly encourage everyone to read it. And thank you again. And with that, we are adjourned.